I'd like to introduce Joe Smoke, who is with the Los Angeles Department of Cultural Affairs and a member of the host committee here in Los Angeles, and he will introduce this afternoon's speaker.
I'm seduced by the reader. After a long day, I often find myself in bed with the reader. As a friend and a fan of today's keynote speaker, it's gratifying to introduce you to Luis Alfaro. Luis is a multi-talented Chicano artist, a performer, a director, a producer, a poet, a journalist, a filmmaker, a teacher, and a community activist. He's been a columnist for the Los Angeles Reader. He has published in more than 25 anthologies. His work was showcased. His Emmy Award-winning short film, Chicanismo, was showcased on our local PBS affiliate, KCETV. He has released a solo spoken word recording called Downtown, two words, with the punk rock label New Alliance, and has developed more than 100 new American theater projects as resident artist at our Mark Taper Forum during the past 10 years. His daring works usually endeavor to explore our world of conflicts and desires, and no doubt his youth on the mean streets of an economically underprivileged but culturally vibrant part of our city, the Pico Union Barrio, west of downtown Los Angeles, has challenged him to become a keen observer, a sharp thinker, and a consistent humorist. Most impressively, following only a high school education, Luis has launched his successful international career with skills gained from community workshops at nonprofit art spaces, most notably LA's Inner City Cultural Center. As a teacher, Luis continues to highlight community connection by asking theater students to become civic participants. He has two or three courses I heard about last night over drinks, one in which college actors are working with sixth graders who have severe attention deficit disorder, and another theater course where students are working with hospital employees. Both of those courses are being taught at our California Institute of the Arts. Luis has received many prestigious nominations, awards, and honors, including the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Fellowship, the Genius Award in 1997, the LA Weekly Queen of Angels Award, La Reina de Angelus, and in 2005, the James A. Doolittle Award from our LA Stage Alliance. I understand Luis is going to be leading us on a talking tour. So get ready for that. Please make this homie feel very welcome by patting your hands together as if you're making delicious homemade tortillas. Mr. Luis Alfaro.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much. You know, every time I do one of these speeches, it just gets harder and harder because they're always so beautiful. And I figure that when I get older and I die, they're going to be like, well, inconsistent artist. He was just okay. So I love hearing them while I'm alive. It's really, really lovely. And it has not escaped me that I should have never given up the hula when I was a child. So I'm going to tell you three little stories about Los Angeles, and before I do, I thought, I was asked by the committee to maybe talk about what the quintessential LA experience might be, and I was thinking about something. I was very embarrassed, but once Joe introduced it, I'm a MacArthur Fellow, I thought, I don't really care what you think, so I'm kind of excited to tell you this story. So about a year ago, I've done a lot of different things in my career, and I've been all over sort of the country, but I've been doing political activism, a lot of community building, a lot of artwork in different communities, and just about a year ago, somebody approached me about doing voiceovers, which is a very Los Angeles thing to do. And so if you're ever listening to Spanish language stations, televisions, I'm the voice of the Welch's grape juice commercial. And it goes something like this. Welch's, el jugo de la gente. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about, very quickly, about how I got that job, because it is the L.A. typical LA experience of how I got that job. So about a year ago, I was at the director Lisa Peterson's house in Silver Lake. She lives on top of a very bohemian hill in Silver Lake, very beautiful, overlooks the Hollywood sign. And we were having this fantastic dinner and talking about arts and culture and community. And lo and behold, I look out of the window and there's six helicopters sort of lined up, and they're very slowly sort of moving across the city. And I couldn't help but just keep looking out the window. And finally they said, "What's going on?" I said, "Something's happening outside. There are these helicopters moving in a very slow line. Turn on the television, turn on the television." And sure enough, it was the quintessential LA car chase, right? And I don't know what happened. I don't know what came over me, but I suggested to all these wonderful, great national artists that we should all go outside and see the car chase, because it seemed to be coming closer and closer to us. And sure enough, we were watching the television, and the car chase was coming closer and closer to Lisa's house, and it was going up Silver Lake Boulevard, and it was moving up Sunset, and it turned on Occidental, and that was Lisa Street, and I got so excited, and I ran outside. And I don't know what happened, and I started waving at the camera. It was just pathetic and sad. And there's a local station called KCAL, Channel 9, and so this crew was coming by beforehand, and they were shooting the people waving, and this guy says, "Are you stupid?" And I said, "Yeah, I am stupid. What am I doing?" So I ran back inside, but unfortunately I'd been filmed. Next day I go to Farmer's Market on 3rd and Fairfax, and I'm having coffee, and this guy from the Abrams Agency, which is one of the largest talent agencies in L.A., comes up to me and he says, "Were you on Channel 9 last night?" And I went, "Oh, my God, I was on Channel 9. And he said, "Well, why don't you come in? We're doing these voiceovers." And I went in, and then a week later, I got $1,000 for a Welch's grape juice commercial. So that is very much what happens in Los Angeles, and that's how you get a job. It doesn't matter how you get on television. It's just that you do. Okay, for the serious work. So I thought, because we've been talking a lot about art and we've been talking a lot about culture, that I wouldn't tell you my feelings about art and culture, but tell you some stories about growing up in Los Angeles and some of the experience of being here. It's a wide ballroom. I'm being upstaged by the balloon design, but I'm going to do my very best. I wore my orange guayabera, my Halloween guayabera, and hopefully I'll keep your attention for the next 15 minutes or so. Ooh, la, 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 I did you wrong. My heart went out to play, but in the game I lost you. What a price to pay. I'm crying. Ooh, baby, baby. Ooh, baby, baby. First time I heard that song, I knew I wanted to be a poet. But sadly, my heart had not been out to play yet, nor had I done somebody wrong. And quite frankly, I was working in a carburetor factory in the city of Vernon, the industrial section of Los Angeles. But the way those words seemed to melt out of Smokey's throat, all silky and soft, I knew they had to be true. The only thing shooting out of me back then was a sharp breath trying to blow away the smell of Bandini Mountain. Bandini Mountain was actually this little hill of really fresh prime manure that stood right next to the Long Beach Freeway and the Alameda Corridor, right next to the carburetor factory that I worked in. Sometimes on my lunch break at the factory, I would stand across the street from the train tracks and I would wave at the people making their way to Union Station on Amtrak's Surfliner. God, nothing hurt more back then than the sight of people going somewhere, anywhere. I went to work in a factory when my father's illness took a turn for the worst. I was 11 years old, and back then there were a lot of illegal factories in L.A. with hired children. I worked on a carburetor line with about 50 other guys, and I was the only one that spoke English. I was sent to work in a factory when someone saw me holding Paul Lee's hand on the playground at 10th Street Elementary School. Sometimes I took the RTD bus to the factory and transferred downtown to the corner of Broadway and 7th. This would give me a chance to see what was on the marquee at the State Theater. Black exploitation films were at their peak then, and I spent every Saturday and Sunday on Broadway and downtown Los Angeles, sitting in theaters like The Tower, The State, The Roxy, The Orpheum. The old Art Deco vaudeville houses slumped over from the weight of neglect. I sat through marathon bills of Pam Grier and Richard Roundtree movies like Blackula, Coffee, Brown Sugar, and Cleopatra Jones. Years later, I saw the actress Pam Grier in Sam Shepard's True West at LATC, the Los Angeles Theater Center. She didn't take off her clothes or pack a 45 in her bra or cut somebody's balls off. It was such a disappointment. Mostly, I was given a ride to work by Pepe and Pantera, two guys who had come over from my dad's hometown in Mexico. They would drive by at 6 a.m. and pick me up. These guys were a couple of morning, moody guys from the rancho who never gave me the time of day, but they loved everything American. On Fridays, we bought steak fries and cashed our checks at Kay's Pastrami Stand on Whittier Boulevard in East L.A. Pepe and Pantera loved to cruise down Whittier Boulevard. Cruising is so American graffiti, and even though it's done by a bunch of Mexicans and the raza on the boulevard, they were an antidote to the harshness of immigrant life. We listened to the oldies on static AM radio and checked each other out. Ooh, baby, baby. Ooh, baby, baby. But the real purpose of Whittier Boulevard was to find girls. And there were a lot of them, and they either walked down the boulevard doing their mandado with their shopping carts or cruising in their own cars, throwing kisses to the boys they liked. We used to call them rucas, and they came in all shapes and sizes, big old chubby rucas, pushing baby strollers, but still sexy enough to work the boulevard, skinny Ted Nugent groupie rucas with faded corduroys and neon tank tops, or scary rucas with chola makeup. I built what was called a 2-502, four sets of 50 a day. That was your quota, and if you didn't meet it, you would have to stay late and finish. The carburetor sold for $50 a piece. I built 200 a day, and I made a whopping $2 an hour. Basically, you start with a base. You lay 20 of them out on a table. You put a series of gaskets over all of the holes, and then you start to insert all of the screws. You put on these big safety gloves, and you use an overhead power screwdriver that trembles in your hand, making you think you have more power than you actually do. And when you have the whole body assembled, you oil the whole carburetor. Then you spray it with a solvent that was illegal in California even back then. You test the shutters, and then you test the switches. No, stupid. The shutters first, then the switches. Otherwise, you flood the carburetor before it even gets installed. Ooh, baby, baby. Ooh, baby, baby. If the base gets cracked, you have to start over. If the screws are bent, use them anyway. If you feel sick, you should keep on working because working is good for the body. If the union guys try to get you to sign a card, tell them you don't believe in the mafia. If you see two employees fighting in the back, it's none of your business. If you want a prostitute, talk to the guy they call El Zurdo. If you want to drink a beer during break, go to the bathroom and do it. If you want to talk English, don't. It makes everybody really mad. And somehow, all of this was made bearable day after day by the thought that on Friday, we would be cruising down the boulevard. All of the guys on the boulevard worked really hard to come home with a kiss. You see, sometimes a ruca would walk up to your cruising Chevy and lean in and give you a kiss on the cheek. And if you go home with one of those rucas kisses on your cheeks, you can pretty much know that everyone will forget that you held hands with Paul Lee in fifth grade. So I worked really hard to get that lip to touch my cheek. And sometimes, most of the time, I didn't get it. So I would run to Señora Galindo's house and see if she would give it to me. Señora Galindo was a dark-skinned Cubana who talked so fast that none of the slow-tongued Mexicans in our neighborhood could understand her. She would say, ¿Cómo está? Did you say, ¿Cómo está? ¡Sí, mi amor! Did you say, ¿Sí, mi amor? Señora Galindo was what the neighborhoods called an eccentric. Así se hace. Do do do. This year, my cousin Weenie, who only eats once a day, is hosting our family reunion in East LA. Everyone's happy because she always kills and cooks a live pig at the family reunion. My mom thinks a family reunion is a bad idea because so many of our relatives died last year. We've already seen everybody at Muriaga's mortuary at least 4 times. Besides, everybody's just going to be depressed. But my Uncle Abel, the one-legged Vietnamer, he says he already ordered the kegs of beer, and what we should really be celebrating is who's alive, which means he's gone off the wagon again, and midway through the reunion, he'll either fall asleep in the driveway or make somebody cry. We get dressed and we head for the bus stop by the convention center. All of us wear our Sunday best, and I've got my favorite clip-on tie that I bought at the Sears on Soto. Clip-on ties make every kid look important and faithful to God. We take the RTD bus to East LA because my dad doesn't like to use up the engine on our brand new station wagon. Besides, he says, why do we want to use up our brand new station wagon on all those backstabbing, good-for-nothing, hijos de la chingada madre? Mom pinches him in the arm and whispers in a voice everyone is supposed to hear that he shouldn't be disrespecting the family because then we all will, but it's too late for that. At the family reunion, I count over 120 alfaros. After the required big circle prayer and the three-legged races, I always go to the backyard and to the garden with my aunt's fish pond, which sits right next to the pig pen, which my aunt says makes the pigs relaxed and happy. They are more tender as ham, she says, because they didn't have a lot of stress in their life due to their peaceful surroundings. I love going to the fish pond because it is the cleanest place in East LA and because my aunt designed it all Chino style. I don't know, maybe my auntie's right. The pigs, they look very relaxed and very happy. But the best thing about the garden is that this is where Uncle Constantine, or Constance, as my mom calls him, sits and smokes long, skinny cigarettes with the holder. He always hangs out in the garden by himself, smoking his Virginia Slims. He is always dressed in white with a scarf around his neck and rings dripping off of his fingers. Uncle Constantine is the star of our family reunions. Everybody talks about him as he wakes his way through the throng of family, kissing aunties on their cheeks and shaking uncle's hands as he nods his head. He pretends not to hear them gossip and giggle as he makes his way through the crowd. Although Uncle Constantine looks like a movie star, I have heard my tías, Romy and Cuca, whisper over cafecito in the kitchen about all the times that Constance has been in prison. Uncle Constantine was a member of the American Communist Party, and he set off a bomb in a police station back when hippies were the normal people. I read about this in a newspaper cutout my mom keeps hidden in the closet. Sometimes Uncle Constantine would show up at 3 a.m. and wake you up in the middle of a dream because he was on the run. Mom cried and she would make bean burritos as he ran off and became darkness in the middle of the night. Uncle Constantine smells all brand new with the scent of tres flores in his hair and the gray flannel smoothly escaping through the back of his neck. You can only see his dark side when he rolls up his sleeves on his white shirt, and you notice the markings. Dark blue, like the color of the ocean at night. The design snake up the inside of his arms and on the joints of his fingers. Tattoo names in deep gang writing. Aztec symbols pricked by homemade needles. The dot, dot, dot of prison life covers him like a map on the skin. When I ask about the markings, he takes a long Ida Lupino drag on a cigarette. He looks skyward. The smoke escapes to his nose and heads to the gods in heaven. I want to be that pose. I don't know why, but I can feel inside me the crease on his pants, the hang of his shirt, the markings on his hand, the deep, dark, mysterious world of knowing. When he looks down at me sitting there on the grass, cross-legged in my clip-on and Sunday suit. He doesn't say anything. He just smiles. And he gives me a look. Not just any look, the look of knowing. And I know that smile like I know how to float in the deep section of the Alhambra pool. You and I understand each other, don't we? Los entendemos muy bien. He says it like he looked deep inside me, behind my esophagus, and found the little heart beating under the shell of me. We look at each other for the longest time until I get ashamed of whatever it is that I'm looking back at. It's not a love feeling at all. It's more like when you're at the zoo and you look at an animal for a really long time and you see a reflection of yourself in that animal. And he stands over me, sitting in the garden. His blue scarred hand brushes over my head. His ballet wrist with the Liz Taylor rhythm, waving goodbye as he says hello to everybody in the crowd. Do 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 do. And I don't know why, but I feel like someone finally looked inside of me and found me. Me, struggling through the gang-infested poverty, loneliness, hate, sadness, poor, Mexican, violent, crowded, dirty, drunks on corner that is my neighborhood downtown. Someone saw the little garden inside of me. On the bus ride home, I sit in silence in the last row of the RTD. I feel calm as my brother, who is sitting next to me, leans deeper into me with every breath of deep sleep. My mom looks over at us and her eyes lock into mine. She always looks at me with such a worried gaze. She never knows what to make of me. Always wondering and worrying about me, my mother. But today on the bus, I'm not concerned. I smile back at her and she returns to whispers with my father. I watch as we pass over the LA River and I feel a calmness and a peace come over me. I think I know who I am. I think I know who I might be. La 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la. There was this woman that we used to listen to this long, hot summer when all we had was an inflatable Sears pool in the backyard. That long, hot summer, my brother and I graduated from Berendo Junior High on Pico and Vermont. We were supposed to go to Belmont High School in our neighborhood, but because of overcrowding, we were told we were going to be bussed. Almost all of the poor Mexican kids in our downtown barrio were sent outside of the neighborhood to Grant High School in the Valley. The Valley? The Valley is where the kids with staircases inside of their houses live. Houses with manicured lawns that don't have my apa's orange Monte Carlo sitting on cinder blocks in the front yard waiting for him to change the rims, the muffler, the whatever, Dad, just do it! La 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 la, la 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 la. La 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 la. We were really scared about busing. We had never really been around people that were not like us. You know, people like us. People that shopped at the mall on Crenshaw and Stalker. People that sewed simplicity patterns made from Newberry clothing stores. People that bought live pigs from the Farmer John's in Vernon. You know, people like us. When the busing letter finally came, my apa was really mad. My brother and I were not going to go to the Valley after all. We were going to go to Wilson High School in East Los Angeles. ¡Cabrones!, my father shouted. How could they send us to a Mexican school in East LA? What was the point of busing anyway? La 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 la, la 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 la. The first day of school, we get off a bus and a sea of brown sweeps over us. In our silk shirts and our platform shoes, we look like two teen pimps. Let's face it, we were downtown, they were East LA. God, it was hard to be Mexican, except at lunchtime. At lunchtime, they used to have noon dances in the gym. This was the big escape of high school for me. The only time in the day when I got lost in the magic of what it was to be American. This was as far away from my father's soccer cleats, domino games in the backyard, and the Espanol we had to speak in the house. Afuera de la casa. We spoke a kind of English that belonged only to us. And that's when I heard it at the noon dances, a song. La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la. Woo! One of those songs that just stays inside of you and wraps itself around your soul. On the album cover of where that song comes from is a woman, a mujer, beautiful with piel de canela, with hands on her hips and one of those I dare you to kiss me looks. She stands next to a lazy lion who is reclining at her feet. She's wearing an angelic white dress with cotton embroidery and baby's breath in her hair. Her hair, a big puffy afro that sits on top of her head like those Imperial Valley tumbleweeds. And her name, Minnie, like something sweet, something American. Not Maria, not Minerva, not mi totera, but Minnie. And she's singing about coming inside of her love, and I don't really get it because I'm a slow ninth grader. But I hear her hold this note, this long, high bird note that reaches for the clouds. Come inside my love. I understand that note like I know how to roller skate without trying. Come inside my love. Oh, man, how come I know that feeling and I ain't even lived yet? I mean, really lived. Fallen in love or kissed someone on the lips or had the government repossess something of mine like Mr. Red Fox. How can you know the soul of soul music? The very next day, I joined the Columbia House Record Club. I ordered 12 new albums, all for one penny. Plus, I get to sample a new record every month. It sounded like such a good offer, didn't it? My ama and my apa were worried about how come I like the black music so much and not the mariachis and the rancheras. They didn't let me listen to the blues in the house. So I started to sneak out and I started honing the sonar devices to listen for the percussive thump, thump, thump of star love in the na-ya-ya-yites. But the radar of my passion was still set on Minnie Riperton's loving you. La 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 la. One Saturday, my ama drove me to a bus stop on Vermont, and I took that bus to a blues joint called the New Mint Saloon. My brother lent me his fake ID, and I shaved, even though I hadn't grown anything yet. And I had never been in a bar before. The smoke and the smell of the liquor made me feel like it was someplace dangerous and adult. I was in the world of knowing. I sat at a little table with a round red candle in the middle. I was nervous, but I could feel the soul inside of my soul start to come out. I was the only Mexican in there, but it didn't matter somehow. And as the night went on, I heard the best of the best. An amazing man named Eddie Cleanhead Vinson laid back and words just melted from his mouth. Harmonica fats blew and blew as sweat rolled down his blazer. Barbara Lynn played a slide guitar. I'd never seen a woman do that before. And she sang her biggest song, "If you should lose me, oh yeah, you'll lose a good thing." Oh, my God, and then something amazing happened. The lights went low, and everything became very, very quiet as church that moment right before communion. From way in the back of the bar, a big, big, heavy man dressed to the nines and in a lavender velvet suit slowly made his way towards the audience. He was on crutches, and he was helped along by two older men in sharp purple pinstriped suits with tails. Mm-hmm. People shook his hand, and he personally said hello to each and every one of us in that bar that night, like maybe he had once been a pope. When he finally made his way to the stage, he sat on a chair, and he just looked out at the audience. He just looked out at that audience like he had been sitting on that stage his whole entire life. Finally, he clutched his harmonica and the microphone together like those Sunday morning preachers do on local TV, and he began to count out a 1, 2, 3. And his body began to bounce around that chair like he was Kathy Rigby in Never Neverland. And people got up and just began to dance. And they started singing with him, and like they had never sung before. And everybody shouted with him as he wailed over and over again. Flip, flop, fly, dance before I die. Flip, flop, fly, dance before I die. And I started to move. Slowly at first. And then I started to sing. And then I started to laugh. And I just started to be my sort of 15-year-old self. La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la. And his name was Big Joe Turner. And I don't know why I was so lucky to see a legend before he died, but I was. And I clapped and I laughed and I couldn't help myself. Because Big Joe Turner was pure joy, pure soul, pure blues. And the Newman Saloon was blown away by his tornado. And in that moment, the mysteries began to reveal themselves to me. I was taken somewhere else. I was transported to a place beyond Vermont Boulevard. I was back in the Central Valley with my grandmother picking grapes off the vine. I was in Tijuana with the other grandmother feeding the pigs. I was watching my dad play football, soccer. I was dancing at a quinceañera with 15-year-old girls. I was roasting a pig from a homemade trash can pit. I was in the world of my people, of downtown street corners, of buying pizza slices from the Woolworths on Broadway, of sitting in the last row of the number 26 bus racing down Pico. I was free. I was a queer Mexicano boy and I was free. La 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 la. 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 But I was also one of the Soul Train dancers. I was one of the 3 degrees. I was one of Harold Melvin's Blue Notes. I was that guy in Bloodstone who sang Natural High. I was Teddy Pendergrass. I was that one stylistic that sang Falsetto. I was one of Frida Payne's backup singers on Band of Gold. I was Tina Marie. I was Minnie Riperton's perfect angel. And you know what? At that moment, I said goodbye to being a boy, and I reached in and I pulled that note. That note on loving you is easy because you're beautiful. Do you know what note I'm talking about this afternoon? And you know what I did? It inched up my spine and it worked itself through all of my body parts and it tugged at my pubic hair and it tickled my little mustache and it found my body and it connected this head, this cabeza tan mexicana with this lengua, this tongue so American, and it worked itself right into my heart, my corazón, and it was then that I could feel the thump, thump, beep, beep of the toot, toot life inside of me. And I held that note as long as I could until I grew up. And I am here to tell you today, Weston people, that I am here to tell you that Minnie Riperton, la 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la. Minnie Riperton saved my life. Thank you. Okay, so very quickly, thank you. Very quickly, I thought I'd end this afternoon with a little blessing. I've been writing blessings, you know, the city of Orange County invited me to bless a tree. I went to Disneyland for the 50th anniversary to bless a stone. So I love getting called. It's like another way of doing civic participation. I'm blessing a lot of trees and parks and doing a lot of that stuff, and I'm really enjoying it. So this is a blessing for all of you this afternoon. Telling a story and the time that it takes to get there. First, it starts with a vision. Not a vision, but a real desire to take it on. And there is always someone who wants to take it on, isn't there? And taking it on has its consequences. They say you're crazy. They threaten to take back your money. They question your artistic integrity. And they write funny things about you in the paper. Your colleagues become acquaintances. Your friends become colleagues. Your actors become enemies. Your enemies become your lovers. Your lover becomes an actor. But you plow ahead because you know it's the right thing, only nobody else knows it yet. And that's the moment when we become artists. We walk through fire, we jump off the cliff, and we decide to tell the truth 24 hours a day. So we take a risk, a real risk. And why? Because we have seen it. The laughter, the love, the heartache, the regret, the sweet memory, the brutal anger, the unbelievable joy, the violent passion, the broken bodies, and that healing performance. But more importantly, we take the risk because we know those feelings from our own hearts. And so we get a vision, a desire to say something about the world. Not about yesterday, not about tomorrow, but about what it means to be living here today. And this is the moment when one should open a building at the intersection of great possibility. Not that you need a building, but everyone wants to come more when you have a building. And I think it's the best when the building has a past, don't you? I think it's the best kind of building, a building with character, a building with the desire to keep expressing itself. And in a city where everyone is older than their buildings, it's great when a building reaches down and swoops you into her arms with her history. And my best building is a theater that has a stage that says, you want excellence? Well, here I am. Be excellent here. And we want to be excellent because people in buildings like this, they still believe in telling stories the old way, but with new ideas. Every day, a story waits to unfold. A city arches its back and reveals its color. A language gets spoken. A person gets lost. A building transforms. A wound gets healed. A body breaks open. And we get to tell the stories that make the difference, that reveal the lies, that make us laugh, that make us human, that give us hope, that heal the heart, that calm the fear, that get the facts, that make us want to be better human beings. Everybody is a poem. Everyone has a story. And it always starts with an empty page, the pen that bleeds onto the canvas of a stage. So today, hello, Gia, I want to ask all of you Gia artists, if you will join me in publicly renewing your commitment to make the work and attempt your excellence in your spaces to imagine all of the possibilities. Will you?
Yes.
Then we are all blessed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So we've ended right on time. There really isn't a lot of time for Luis to take questions, but I'm sure he'll be sitting around here. So enjoy the break and the rest of the day.